Hello, Falava. This is Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Susana Sirisuiki. Coming up,
we will be focusing on counting. So hopefully counting will start on the 18th.
Polling day in Solomon Islands runs smoothly and peacefully. Also, New Zealand's army lends a helping hand to Tonga during an exercise. Meanwhile, an ancient city has been uncovered in the kingdom. Polling is now closed in Solomon Islands after what has been a peaceful and orderly election so far. Over 400,000 people registered to vote for their parliamentary and provincial representatives for the next 4 years. Kuroi Hawkins is in the capital, Honiara, and filed this report.
Sheer determination is the phrase that came to mind while watching the long lines of voters patiently queuing up to cast their ballots. Most seemed to be in good spirits, only dampened by the temperamental weather, which seemed to have only two settings, torrential downpour or tropical heat wave.
Okay, so the process is like this. We've been putting one tent outside.
In West Honiara, the presiding officer at the Agape 1 polling station, Bobby Naftalai, ran a well-oiled operation with a steady stream of voters going in and out of the open-air venue. This is the first time Solomon Islands is conducting national and provincial elections simultaneously, so all voters seem to need a little direction. Yellow for provincial, white for national. As far as election issues go, voters I spoke to had varied responses. A young voter, Timothy Bai, says he's unhappy with the former government's decision to cut ties with Taiwan in 2019 and establish ties with China.
Now I want to see a change. My aim in voting now is for a new government because we're a democratic country, but we shifted diplomatic ties from a democratic to a communist country.
For Mini Kasi, her focus was what leaders could do for her and her community.
My voting experience was good. I came to vote for the right person for West Honiara. Over the past 4 years, I did not see anything delivered by the person I voted for last time, which is why I am voting for the person I voted for today.
For Ethel Manera, the big election issues were development and delivery of basic government services.
Some infrastructure and sanitation they have not developed and they are still yet to develop. That is what I see should be developed in our country.
The chief electoral officer, Jasper Anisi, says the counting of votes will begin tomorrow, starting with the provincial ballots.
We will be focusing on counting. So hopefully counting will start on the 18th, but mostly it will be verification of ballot papers and ballot boxes from the polling stations. And once verification is done, then counting will automatically start.
The police presence in the capital has been high today, with personnel from regional police and military services supporting the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force. So far, no serious security issues have been reported.
A preliminary report into the Lulutai Airlines plane incident in Tonga has found a host of safety problems with the aircraft. The aircraft lost control while taxiing at Fuamotu Airport on Tongatapu last December, hitting a cement block on the side of the apron. The SAA B340 aircraft, carrying 35 passengers, was returning to Fuamotu after aborting its trip to Vava'u due to a hydraulic leak, according to the crew. A Civil Aviation Authority report said the source of the hydraulic leak has not been identified because of the damage to the undercarriage of the plane. RNZ Pacific's correspondent in Tonga, Galafi Moala, told Don Wiseman these are not the only issues facing Lulutai.
Definitely they say that there was something broken in the plane itself so that they could not stop or give it direction when they were on the ground. Apparently the pilot had no control over it, so that's why it went off course and hit the cement block, then it broke down. But that was not only a case. There was also recently, and we're talking about a couple of weeks ago, where they had a forced landing for one of our remaining planes, the Y-12 plane, because of, again, mechanical problems, which caused a lot of delays. And then, of course, we're still talking about the other plane that was supposed to have already been bought, the Twin Otter plane, to arrive in Tonga. So, yeah, it does not look good. And it's not a matter of looks. It's very, very inefficient and causing a lot of problems for domestic travel by air.
Yes, well, it's the only airline, effectively, isn't it, operating in the country?
That's right. It's the only one. And, of course, there was a time when they were an open bidding for a company to run the airlines. And then there was a company called Real Tonga, which was privately owned, that came in for a time. And then the government decided to do another bidding, and Real Tonga applied. But then the government decided to start their own company. And that's what happened to Lulu Thai. And that's not long ago. It's this government. So we're talking about 2-3 years ago.
It's been a problem since the beginning, essentially, hasn't it, Lulu Thai?
It has been definitely a problem, Don. You know, Tongan people, like other Pacific Islanders, are very superstitious. And when you have an airline that continues to have mechanical problems and it's got security issues associated with it, people are starting to talk. But one of the things that has just also been exposed recently is that this airline is not owned by the public enterprises. In other words, all businesses run by government comes under public enterprise. But apparently this government decided to form its own company outside of public enterprises, which is the Lulu Thai Airlines, and they ran it. Another interesting factor to this is the guy who is the CEO to Lulu Thai Airlines was the guy that they lost his parliament seat just a couple of years ago because of bribery in the election. So this government brought him back and made him the CEO of Lulu Thai. So there's a lot of problems associated with this airline.
Are people forming queues as patrons to use the airline? What's happening with it?
No, they're going by boat. There's some people just cancel travels. But what is concerning is that how it affects tourism, because a lot of tourists that would come into this country, they want to go to Valao. Very uncertain scheduling. And, of course, these mechanical problems are becoming a huge issue to our tourism industry.
A New Zealand-led multinational force is heading to Tonga to assist local communities in the Ha'apai Islands. Exercise Tropic Twilight will see 68 units from New Zealand, 8 from Tonga and 10 from other regional partners collaborate in engineering and medical projects. Whenua Whenua spoke with the New Zealand Squadron Major James Brosnan, who is the Senior National Officer for Exercise Tropic Twilight.
Could you describe this exercise in Tonga?
Yes, so Exercise Tropic Twilight is a New Zealand Defence Force-led exercise focusing on humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. It is a Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade-funded activity, which we're focusing on Tonga this year, in order to build resiliency against future disasters and to support stability within the region.
You talked about disaster resilience. Could you expand on some of the things you'll be training on in regards to that?
We are deploying a 78-strong team to the Ha'apai Island Group in Tonga, and what we're going to focus on is renovating community facilities within the island to support them in any future disasters. So examples of that include constructing a toilet block at an evacuation centre and accessibility ramps into that facility. We're also going to do repair works on 2 schools, which are also used as evacuation points in the communities.
Are there any other participants in this exercise besides the New Zealand Defence Force and Tongan Army?
Yes. So we have invited international partners who support the Pacific. This year that includes participants from Vanuatu, Fiji, Papua New Guinea, Australia, United Kingdoms and Japan.
And how important are exercises like this with Pacific Island countries?
It's important for us as New Zealand to have these exercises in the Pacific with our Pacific partners. Because it allows us to operate together, to better understand ourselves and how we integrate with each other. And it also allows us to be ready for any future deployments where we may operate together.
Is there, and the military aspect of this, the defence aspect, could you describe what kind of training it would involve?
So the team will be focused on construction effects, which is one of the key outputs of the group going there. And health effects. So these are both enabling activities that would support any military operations if we were to deploy elsewhere.
How many soldiers are being deployed, units being deployed to Tonga for this?
Yes. So there is a 78-strong team deployed to Tonga, which includes 10 international partners, and we will also meet up with another 8 Tongan military coups once we arrive in country. The exercise will be for 30 days over the month of May.
Research released by doctoral students at the Australian National University shows large low-density urbanised settlements existed in Tonga nearly 2,000 years ago. This is about 1,000 years earlier than previously thought. Lead researcher Philip Parton says the present-day village of Mu'a in Tongatapu was the largest site and was once home to dozens of large stoneworks and raised homes for over several thousand people. He told On Wiseman about the discovery.
Until this, we didn't know. Required sort of two things. The data set, the laser scanning data set. In other parts of the world, that type of information has been critical at defining and identifying urban systems. I'm thinking of places like Angkor Wat and Central America. They're really big ones at the moment. And so getting our hands on that data set and myself in my thesis, then it started by mapping archaeological features. We can see that by there's about 10,000 odd mounds in the bush around Tongatapu. And so, yeah, started with the painstaking work of mapping them. And then once that map was created, putting that information into urban analysis type methods and models from other parts of the world. And then the other end of that machine, it's sort of saying, okay, well, there's similarities here to what we call urban settlements in other parts of the world. But then there's also a low density side of the title that there's unique kind of Tongan ways of doing it. So yeah, similarities and differences.
When we talk about low density, we're talking about like a village with everyone having a few acres.
Yeah, correct. And it's a term that sort of stands in contrast to what my background from Europe, you know, what we consider urban being high density clusters of things. So it's a term that stands in contrast to that. They have the same features, but people have a small little parcel that they can grow crops on, have other little houses for family, visitors, etc. So we're talking about, I think in the Tongan situation, about 6 to 7 people per hectare, when a modern city might have a couple of hundred per hectare.
Now, we know that Polynesian communities were living in forms of urban areas. In Aotearoa, Maori lived in pas, for instance, and I'm sure there were similar sorts of arrangements in other parts of Polynesia. And we know that there were developments of this type in Tonga about 1,000 years AD, but you're suggesting this happened another 1,000 years earlier than that.
Yeah, the first signs that we get from the archaeological investigations that we've done actually in the field suggests that some of these mounds were being built from as early as 300 AD, which we used to think that that all started at 1000 AD. So that in itself is a really interesting finding from this, but it also doesn't fit in a way. It challenges us to think about how these kind of traditional models of the development societies might be different, like what we've got right, what we've got wrong, what we need to think more about, and then similarities to Maori pa sites, etc. Like, how do we integrate developments that are happening in what we call Western Polynesia with Eastern Polynesia? And we know that they weren't isolated from each other. There's things moving backwards and forwards, material goods, ideas. So yeah, probably a bigger step from beyond this is, how do we integrate these similar things that we see right across the region and not just in Tonga Samoa, Fiji kind of area?
Now, these mounds, what do they signify?
Well, we think they're most likely the site of residences. We've got some of the excavations that we've done. We've recovered what you call domestic goods, so things like shellfish remains that obviously been discarded on the site. We've got other domestic things like oven stones, broken fragments of adzes. And then there's also, in the way that they're constructed, there's a series of what we're calling floors. So every 300, 400 mil, there's a new kind of surface being created. And so, yeah, our current best guess at that is that they were the places of houses. And when you stand on the top of them, you get a wonderful view that catches breezes. And one of the days when I was out there working was torrential rain. So the tops of the mound becomes really dry with pools of water at the base of it. So I suspect they were probably pretty nice places to live.
So avoiding flooding, tidal waves, all this sort of thing.
Yeah. And to get further into the weeds of the urbanization model, part of elevating your structures and putting them onto really solid permanent foundations is it's about managing the growth of settlements. And so you might see that in other ways by there being informal tracks suddenly become formalized into roads and networks, and elevating your dwelling to be above and breaking up sight lines is another way that the residents can help mitigate some of those stresses involved with putting more people into smaller spaces. So it links to that urbanization model as well.
Do we know what sort of numbers were living in these urban places?
My guess, I have a earlier paper where I re-estimated the population of Taumatapu based on similar sort of, well, the same data that we're using here, the LIDAR laser scanning. And we worked out that there were probably close to 50 or 60,000 people living on the island prior to European contact. And so using that same methodology, I'm estimating about 6,500 to 7,000 people in the main capital city there.
And that main capital city is where?
That's in the eastern side of Taumatapu. In the past, it's called Mua, and Mua refers to today three villages: Talasiu in the north, Lapaha in the middle, and Te Takamotonga in the south. When you drive through there today, you probably wouldn't notice the differences, but they are three distinct villages with three different chiefly titles attached to them. And in the past, they were described as Mua.
We know further down the line, by the time Cook arrived in the 18th century, that it was well laid out, roads everywhere, this sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think with the laser scanning data combined with those radiocarbon date, that pattern that he's observing, you can see that in the way that the mounds are laid out. A lot of them are on grid. They face roughly the same kind of way. So that pattern that he's writing about, drawing about, we get that first view of that at 8300. So that's a really 1600 years of a really resilient settlement form. And we're seeing these things come in at 8300, but I'd suggest that it's highly unlikely that wasn't when they were first invented, that these settlement forms probably existed a couple of hundred years earlier, but just weren't built in those permanent materials like mounds. And so in a sense, they're lost to us today because no record of it exists.
That's Pacific Ways for today. To listen back, head over to rnzi.com/programs. We're also on Spotify, Apple and iHeartRadio. From myself and the RNZ Pacific team, tō whā soifua.